had a class in seminary's homiletics on preaching, and the professor kept making comments about the to this one time. He's criticizing this one speaker because he was kept always staying over on one side, and then the class points out that's where everybody was, because the room was kind of a weird room, and the way the aisle was, everybody was on that one side, and the professor hadn't made that observation. But so at least you're balanced, see? Spread out nice and neat there. Well, actually, my choice of black is somewhat intentional. We've come to the conclusion, basically, of Kings and to the fall of Jerusalem. What a very sad time in Israel's history. The great kingdom that this promised land that they left Egypt for, and they're crying out to God, remember us, and Moses comes, and there's a deliverance out of Egypt. A building, kind of a time in the wilderness, was actually to build up the nation, and then through their disobedience, what would have been a year and a half, 2 year time period before they went into the promised land ended up being a 40-year period. And those that would have entered didn't enter, and a new group came along, and they entered through Joshua and conquest of the land, but yet never quite follow the Lord completely and arrive there. Period of the judges, but then came that point where they said, we want to be like the other nations. We want a king. And God said, this isn't a good thing, but he allowed it. And so Saul became king, but he didn't really have that heart after God, and he had some things that were more important to him than obedience. And then David came upon, and David was this great king. And following David was Solomon, and Solomon, because of all the things that David laid out, Solomon was able to have a great kingdom, the greatest in the world. Built a temple, had vast expanses, but Solomon had his own problems. Solomon, married many wives and foreign women, and they brought into that foreign gods. And Israel started to decline. And with that, the nation was judged, and the kingdom was split, and there were two nations now. Israel was the northern kingdom, and while it could have been a great kingdom, Jeroboam, the first king, chose to not follow Yahweh, but to come up with his own religion. It was kind of a religion unto Yahweh, but it wasn't the way Yahweh prescribed it. And it set that nation on a course of always walking away from God. So every king of the northern kingdom was evil. Some much, much worse than others. And in the middle you had the kings of Ahab and that family, that dynasty that was just horrible. And then at the end it got worse again. But always bad kings. But in the south you had some good kings and some bad kings, and toward the end, some very evil kings. The southern kingdom lasts almost 200 years longer. But Manasseh came on the scene, and the fall of Jerusalem begins. He built altars to Baal, as Ahab had done. He erected altars. He seduced Judah to do more evil than the nations that Yahweh had destroyed during the days of Joshua. He murdered innocent people, many, many innocent people. Of Manasseh, it says, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominations, having done wickedly more than all the Amorites who were before him, and has also made Judah sin with his idols. Therefore, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such calamity on Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle. And that figure of speech at the end, that his ears will tingle, it probably would translate into our language as people will not believe it. If you heard what was going to happen, you just wouldn't believe it. It's beyond imagination. Manasseh was such an evil king. The northern kingdom had its evil, and Ahab was, you know, maybe the apex of that, but Manasseh put that to shame. Not only did he incorporate everything that Ahab had, he brought in every other worship around the world he could think of. And God said, that's it. This nation will cease. This nation will be judged. However, he had a grandson, Josiah. He did right in the sight of the Lord. He walked in the ways of King David. He restored the Passover. Wrong one here. Get my directions. And of Josiah, God said, because your heart was tender and you humbled yourself before the Lord and you have torn your clothes and wept before me, therefore your eyes will not see all the evil which I will bring on this place. So Josiah was this king that brought grace to the nation because of his humble attitude. He was a good king from the very beginning. Then the law was rediscovered, and he was humbled when he saw the things that they hadn't kept, the things they hadn't been doing. And he sought out from a prophet, well, what does God have for us? And it came, judgment is still coming, but because you're humble, because you have a tender heart, you won't see that judgment. You won't see that judgment. Well, that brings the setting. The setting for the fall of Jerusalem. After 55 years of Manasseh's evil, and after 31 years of grace during Josiah's reign, the next 22 years would be devastating. Invasions after invasions after invasions. Egypt would start off, but then Babylon would become the power of the world, and Babylon would just devastate Judah. On three separate occasions, many people were uprooted and taken to Babylon. In the end, only the very poorest were left to work the fields. The 22 years of final judgment consisted of a 3-month reign, followed by 11-year reign, followed by a 3-month reign, followed by 11-month reign, or 11-year reign. You know, you could read that and say, well, sounds like the writer was manipulating things to make the story more interesting. And if that's your bent, then that's probably the kinds of things you'll conclude. Or you see in this God's hand. Not circumstances by any means. And as will be shown in the text, it's not really Babylon through its power that is winning, but it's God that is establishing these defeats. Judgment is at hand. It's through four kings. The first, Jehoaz. About 609 B.C., he became king. He was the son of Josiah. He was 23 years old. He reigned for 3 months. It's hard to believe that you could reign for 3 months and on your epitaph, on your tombstone, it would say, did evil in the sight of the Lord. But that's what his would have said. He was imprisoned by a Pharaoh. So Egypt was a power at this time, and Egypt had came down at the end of Josiah's reign, and then again, and took this, whatever he did, didn't do, the Pharaoh wasn't happy with, and took him off to prison. Jehoiakim becomes the next king. He was appointed by the Pharaoh. He's the son of Josiah. He was 25 years old. He reigned 11 years, did evil in the sight of the Lord. During his reign, Nebuchadnezzar conquers Judah. The first deportation, which undoubtedly included Daniel and his friends, took place in his time. And he rebelled. He rebelled. This is the political fall of Jerusalem. This is when Jerusalem loses all autonomy, never to truly be a nation again. And there is, in our lifetime, that Israel has returned to that land in a sovereign power. But that would be the first time since 605 B.C. Now, I think, biblically speaking, that establishment of Israel under God's kingdom is yet to come. In chapter 23, verse 34, we see, where the Pharaoh makes Josiah's son king, changed his name. Tells verse 36 how old he was, and then in chapter 24 it says, in his days Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. So he's king, but he becomes the servant. So there's really no kingdom anymore. Then he turned and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. And you know what you expect to read in the next verse? Is Nebuchadnezzar sent his army to straighten this out. But we read, the Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, bands of Armenians, bands of the Moabites, bands of the Amorites and Monites. So he sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of the Lord which he has spoken through his servants and prophets. Surely at the commandment of the Lord it came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood which he shed. And he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not forgive. The Lord would not forgive. The Lord was not going to have another interval of grace here. The judgment has been coming, and now the judgment will come. And Manasseh is the one king that becomes the downfall of Jerusalem. I mean, there's been in Judah, there have been different times they've slipped lower and lower, but under Manasseh, it finally came to the point that God said, that's it. Though His grace stepped in during Josiah's time, and grace intervened for 31 years, but now God says, no. You just continue and you continue and you continue. Judgment will come. Verse 6 says, so Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiakim, his son, became king in his place. So we have a new king. The third king in this 22-year period, as been mentioned, he's the son of the previous king, Jehoiakim. He was 18 years old when he became king. He reigned for 3 months.
He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He was taken captivity by King Nebuchadnezzar. And in his short reign, when he's taken in captivity, is the second time people are taken out of Judah and taken to Babylon. In verse 8 of chapter 24, it says Jehoiakim tells us, you know, he was 18 years old, etc., etc. Verse 10, at the time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother, and his servants, and his captains, and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. That'd be in the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. They all go out and surrender, basically. Verse 13, he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, the king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led away into exile all Jerusalem, and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. So he led Jehoiakim away into exile to Babylon. Also the king's mother and the king's wives and his officials and his leading men of the land. And he led away into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. It's not a very great time. You know, as you kind of read through this, it's all so matter of fact and fast paced. Kind of reminds me, in one sense, of watching a movie. You're watching a movie, or not so much a movie, but maybe a TV show would be better. And it's one that's got a lot of intrigue in it, a lot of puzzles, a lot of different things, and nothing's really resolved. And you kind of glance at the clock, and it's 6 minutes till the hour. And you're kind of like, okay, this is either going to be continued or they're going to solve this ridiculously fast. And you're never sure. Sometimes they continue it, make it a two-part thing, and sometimes it just all gets solved. All of a sudden, kind of like the Perry Masons, nothing's quite as simple as that, but at the end, Perry Mason stands up and says, well, this and this, this happened. And you're kind of like, well, it'd been nice if he'd gave us a clue during the movie about those people. We never even saw them. But nowadays, they kind of introduce them a little bit, but it all gets resolved very quickly. You know, Kings is almost like that. We've had this long book, you know, two books that have gone along leading up to the downfall of Judah. But when it gets here, these 22 years are just packed in. It's just matter of fact, this happens, this happens, this happens. Makes you wonder what the writer was thinking. I mean, it's come to a point where it's just too depressing to go into details. It's just the same old story. Why keep rehashing it to be the same for all of them? Because there wasn't any change here. They're always just stupid. They're servants to the greatest king on the earth at the time, and yet some of them are stupid enough to rebel against even him and try to proclaim that they're actually some sovereign power again. And each time it gets worse and worse and worse. The first time it's really a political captivity. They lose their sovereign power and some are taken. The second time, many are taken and the temple is plundered. But then comes the fourth king. Zedekiah. He was appointed by King Neb. He's the son of Josiah, actually. So they go back. He's very young, but he's the son of Josiah. He's 21 years old. He reigned 11 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He rebelled against King Neb, and there's a six-month siege comes against Jerusalem. And it ends with a very ugly execution of the king and his family. And it's the third time that people are taken into captivity. And the temple is destroyed. It's burnt. And what's left of the temple is taken out. And there's a little more detail given here in this one. Chapter 24 and verse 20. For though the anger of the Lord, for through the anger of the Lord this came about in Jerusalem and Judea until he cast them out of his presence. And Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. You even see here this whole idea of rebellion. You kind of go, how could they be so stupid? But we see there's a divine activity behind that. And you know how that works, I'm not sure. Is it so much that God caused them to be so stupid to rebel against King Nebuchadnezzar? Or is it that God just continually withdraws His grace and people act in their own evil nature when that occurs? Whatever the case, he rebels against King Nebuchadnezzar. The result is a six-month siege. Verse 1 of chapter 25, Now it came about in the ninth year of his reign, on the ninth day of the tenth month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all of his army, against Jerusalem, camped against it, and built a siege wall around it. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. I said 6 months, I meant 18 months, a year and a half here. Can you imagine that we're in Tulsa and somebody comes and basically, you know, of course, it would be a little more enclosed because it has a wall around the city. That's how you protect yourself. But nevertheless, somebody comes up and they set up barricades all the way around your wall of protection, meaning you can't get out. You can't go out to the fields. You can't bring anything in. Whatever your elevators hold, that's what you have. And they obviously had some pretty good supplies to last that long, but eventually, you have nothing. People are starving. The prophets talk about this. In Jeremiah, Lamentations, they talk about this horrible time. But finally, the people have no food. The city was broken into, and all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls beside the king's garden through the Chaldeans, though the Chaldeans were all around the city, and they went by the way. So they run away. People are scattering. But Nebuchadnezzar's men see the king, and they pursue him. The king is caught. Verse 6, Then they captured the king and brought him to the king of Babylon. He passes sentence on him. Just a horrible sentence. Verse 7, They slaughtered his sons before his eyes, and they put out his eyes. And then they put chains on him and took him back to Babylon. What a horrible, horrible conclusion to a life. Then the temple is burnt, verse 8. About a month later, captain of the guard comes from Nebuchadnezzar in verse 9. He burnt the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses in Jerusalem. Even every great house he burnt with fire. you know, when we come back later and reading Nehemiah of them trying to rebuild the city and Ezra trying to rebuild the city. I mean, this city is destroyed. Every great house has been burnt. The king's palace is burnt. The temple has been burnt. The walls, you know, crumble. It's been devastated. And then in one of the more graphic, as far as the expressive segments, verse 13 through 17, the writer describes the plundering of the temple. Now remember, in an earlier time, they already took all the gold out. So here the focus is more on things of bronze. But beyond just taking things as you could go in and the things you could cart off, they go in this time and they look at bronze pillars and big things and they saw them up because they're too big to haul off in whole pieces, and they cut them up in pieces to take them out. And the writer describes these. While he passes over the judgment on the people and the land and the kings pretty fast, he comes to this part and describes the very last of the temple being destroyed. Verse 13, now the bronze pillars which were in the house of the Lord, and the stands and the bronze sea which were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried the bronze to Babylon. They took away the pots, the shovels, the snuffers, and the spoons, and all the bronze vessels which were in the temple service. The captain of the guard also took away the fire pans and the basins that was fine gold and what was fine silver. The two pillars, the one sea, and the stands which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord. The bronze of all these vessels were beyond weight. The weight of the one pillar was 18 cubits, and the bronze capital was on it. And the height of the capital was 3 cubits, and the network and the pomegranates on the capitals all around, all of bronze. And the second pillar was like these of the network. Took everything that was there of value. They had to saw it up. If they had, whatever they had to do to salvage it, they took it. And then they burnt the temple. And then there were more executions. They gathered the chief priest and his secondary priest and the officers of the temple. Verse 19, they take all the officials, the men of war, the five king's advisors, the captain, the scribe to the captain, and 60 men of the people of the land who were found. They brought them to the king in Babylon, and they were executed. So in 605, you had the first deportation. You also had the political fall of Jerusalem. 597, you have the second deportation. In 586, you have the third deportation and the destruction of the temple. So Judah was led away into exile from its land. You know, Kings is not written as just a history. It's, in one sense, it is not a historical book of history. It's a historical book of the spiritual history of the Kings. It tells of their spiritual nature or lack of it. The book of Kings was written for a group of people that are trying to rebuild their lives in this destroyed land of Judah as they come back out of captivity, and they're trying to make sense of what life is because they don't know life here. They haven't been here. So you sit down and you read, or you hear read to you. Here's the history. This is the history of our people.
So we didn't grow up here. We grew up in Babylon, but we've come back. And this is who we really are. And this is how we got to where we are today.
So you just think for a moment of where they are. Okay, Abraham was our father and he was called. He was called by God to be the father of our nation. And he goes and he follows God. And he has children and they have children and they have children. And these are our forefathers. And then through God's divine providence, one of those children is placed in Egypt and becomes, if you would, the vice king, second to only the king. And there's this great famine on the world, and it's because he's in that strategic place that all of his family that's been long estranged can come to Egypt and survive. And during 400 years, and because of the prejudice type, I guess you would call it, in Egypt, they left that people alone. There's no intermarrying in that. And they actually grew. But yet during that time period, as they get large as people, the kings that had forgot the loyalty and the position of this family, they make them slaves. And they cry out to God, and God hears them and sends Moses. Moses is the deliverer, if you would. They come into a promised land. They have their own nation. They prosper, but they want to be like others. They can't be happy with God being their king. They want their own king that they can see, that can go before them. And so the kings start. And you have Saul, and then you have David. And David is this man after God's own heart. As I mentioned earlier, the great kingdom, and he put everything in place for his son Solomon to be successful. And the temple is built, and the Solomon's wisdom, and people come from everywhere to see Solomon and this great kingdom that's established. But yet, this great king, this wise king, is so very foolish as he marries foreign women and brings their religion into his life. The kingdom is split now. And it starts down and down and down. There are times of upticks, but it's down. But as you read this, why is it ever down? What is the problem? The problem always is worshiping something that's not God. Worshiping the gods of other people. The pragmatic things that people come up with to say, oh, well, we need rain. Let's pray to the rain god. Let's come up with a rain god so we can get rain. And over and over and over through this history of this people, God shows that those gods have no power. Yahweh alone is sovereign. And so it's this very sad ending to this nation. Though in one sense, as we know, it really isn't an ending. It's a period of time that they will be in captivity. 70 years. 70 in one sense, 70 years from that political destruction, there will be a return. 70 years from that destruction of the temple, the temple will start to, or will be rebuilt. There will be a return. But what's so important for these people to understand, and reading Kings perhaps helped them to understand that, is that the worship of others is not allowed. And though Israel would never return to that independent sovereign nation, in the remaining years, Israel would not be a nation that pursued false gods. You know, as you read through the Bible, and even reading through all of the Kings,
the grace of God is just, it's there. It's incredible. We've seen it with Ahab, that this very wicked, wicked king, God gave him time after time and intervened in ways to give him the opportunity to respond, and he never would. The nation, both the north and the southern kingdoms, they had their opportunities, but they keep moving away and away and away. And you have kings like Manasseh that just bring such evil. God says, that's it. That's enough. But even when God says that's enough, that doesn't mean he stops his plan. Because he had made a promise to David. And so all this destruction is going on. Back in 605, there was a 16-year-old boy that was taken to Babylon. He has incredible influence on Babylon. For the next 20 years of his life, Babylon will be in charge of his homeland, and then his homeland will be destroyed. But Daniel is placed by God in this position. And as you go and you look at Daniel, what you see in Daniel is that there's been a shift. And now we're in the times of the Gentiles, because it's the Gentiles that are in control of Jerusalem, not the kings of David, not the kings, the sons of David. And God just continues to work. And he says, okay, so the Gentiles are in control. Well then, Nebuchadnezzar, let me introduce myself to you. God is still a sovereign God. You know, this is a very difficult section for us to grasp it in a way that says, okay, is there something edifying here? Because what it is, you just see destruction, destruction, destruction. You know, perhaps the edifying thing here is, okay, God will one day balance the books. God has said their judgment's going to come. Judgment will come. There is that place where God says, okay, this is over. It's the time. There's no more forgiveness, as that term might be used there, in the sense of the end is here now. But yet, none of these things ever threaten God's ultimate plans. And it's so hard to believe as you read through this, because it's like, well, gosh, this has really messed things up. This was supposed, you know, the line of David, the Messiah, is supposed to come here, and the kingdom is gone now. No. God says, well, I'm going to put them in captivity for 30 years, 70 years. I'm going to restore this thing. And now they're not going to go. I'm not going to put them back to that sovereign nation until the Messiah is on the throne. But they will be regathered and they will be my people. I still have a place for them. I still have a plan. God is never threatened by it. You know, it's thinking about this driving over this morning. I think, you know, people that do apologetics, I think it's wonderful. I think there's places in the Bible that would encourage it. I think those philosophical types that are able to argue points, I think it's a great place. I don't mean anything negative about that. God is never an apologist. He doesn't argue with anybody about, here, let me convince you that I'm God. It's just simply, I'm God. Those have no authority, no power. They can do nothing. I can. See, the Bible doesn't have to argue for God in that regard. It just presents God as the sovereign God. And even though Israel is destroyed now, what we see next is God just moves right into the next phase. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar, you're in charge right now. Okay? Let's get acquainted.
and God continues to work. Israel is not the nation it could have been. Things aren't what they could have been, but God's plan continues. And one day the Messiah will sit on the throne of Israel. But at this point, as Kings comes to an end, there's a little bit more of it, but as it comes to an end, it's a very dark, dark day. All the promise, all the hopes, everything that was there, from the call of Abraham to when Moses leads the nation, this fledgling nation, this people that's going to be a nation, out of Egypt into the promised land, all the glory that could have been, all the glory that was even achieved under David and Solomon, has all come to a very dark, dark end. But you have to remember, that's just part of the story. Because the people reading the story that it was written to, in one sense, are people like us that are looking back saying, what's our spiritual heritage? Who is this God we serve? And if he had abandoned them, then there would be no one to read the story. It's not that God abandoned. It's that God set a judgment, a discipline, so that people would be restored and worship him and him alone. And that's the call for us, I believe, as we look at this ending, is the reminder that it's Yahweh and Yahweh alone that is worthy of worship. And that Yahweh does not give up on his own. He called them. There's a severe discipline judgment here, but yet the remnant is always there. And to that remnant, they will be restored. And as we have the various captivities, there will be the restorations under Ezra and Nehemiah. The kingdom will not be a sovereign, independent nation, but it will be restored. It will be there. Jesus will come. And then one day, he will return. And that nation will have its king and its land once again. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank you so much for your word. Even the passages that are so very difficult to interact with. Passages that are either difficult and hard to understand, or passages that are just depressing. When those passages are linked to other passages, we find hope rekindled. Father, help us to learn from this history of the kings, the spiritual strengths and the spiritual wanderings, that we might be those that do right in your sight. And we do pray in Christ's name. Amen.